Welcome to this new episode of CCIST AWAS. I am Shamila Rodriguez.
And I am Sarah Demirov.
We are here with Basha Busit from UCL. One more time. It is our third episode. Last time, while talking about educating the educator, Basha showed us the philosopher and scientist faces of the child. Even though we had an idea about child curiosity, through some comparisons with social psychologists like Piaget and Vygotsky, we have learned much more about the specific characteristics of Korczak's approach and his unique experience in the beginning of the 20th century.
And today, we are here to continue from the points where we paused. From the beginning, it's apparent that we have been wandering around Janusz Korczak because of Basha's expertise about his life and work. This podcast serial idea would address Janusz Korczak as we considered, but I think there is something more. Different phases of Korczak lead us to reconsider education, child collectivity, all various adjectives and definitions of the child in both pre-modern and modern society, etc. And today we will continue his identity as a children's book writer. For sure, children's literature is another crucial issue to mention, and it would be a different topic for further conversations. But here, from Janusz Korczak's perspective, what did children's literature mean? Did he write his novels with a specific purpose to tell an alternative story for the future society? I'm asking a big question like this because, as a fiction writer, I know that writing is an extremely powerful action. Although you can't realize your opinions in the existing society you were born uneducated in, and sometimes you are exposed to a negative aspect. You can create whatever you desire through fictional writing. As another thing, we know that Korczak also wrote fantasy novels, and fantastic fiction might be a strategic way to tell a real story through metaphors, not to take the attention of the authorities perhaps. So, Basha, could you tell us about Janusz Korczak as a writer? What can you say for his characteristics in children's literature different from the other writers?
I'm sorry for our long introduction, but perhaps for listeners who are not familiar with Korczak as a writer, this would be a fresh start for today's conversation.
Of course. I'll start by saying Korczak was a prolific writer. He won a writing competition when he was in high school, and he continued to publish his whole life. So more than 25 books and 1,000 shorter texts. So back then he was famous, and his books were translated into English, French, other languages. And before we talk about some of his work, I want to discuss something Saran mentioned, and that is his purpose as a writer. So not all of his ideas were completely original or completely new, but yet his books were unique. They were surprising. So we can think of Korczak as a publicist. His skill as a writer was explaining ideas to different people, usually in a way that appears to be really simple. For example, one economist calls his children's book Bankruptcy of Little Jack. He calls that the first economics textbook in independent Poland. So let's think about that for a minute. Most Polish people at that time, this is 1920s, most Polish people were barely literate. So such books taught about financial matters in the home. But what was happening also with political decisions at a national level? Now, it gave children an upper hand over the vast majority of adults who had never heard of the type of economic concepts that Korczak introduced. So it also inspired many children to start school cooperatives and banks. And there are still more than 6,000 of these operating in Poland today.
So under the Russian Empire, Basha, there was censorship. But once Poland gained independence, Korczak could write more freely. So why do you think he stick with his subversive style?
Well, the censorship of on Korczak in the Russian Empire was the majority of his writing career in his adult life, really. He couldn't write freely until he was almost 40 years old. But there was more to that, because the hatred and the rivalries did not go away just because new borders were drawn. We have to think, be quite careful about simplifying this period between World War I and World War II, the interwar period. And we have to think about Korczak with the historical context. These were dangerous times, right? Politics was absolutely chaotic in Eastern Europe. And especially in Poland, various groups exploited the mistrust, the jealousies in this power struggle. It's not that different from political strategies that are used today, but it is a mistake to homogenize all the Poles as right-wing nationalists, for example. We have to remember that the first president of Poland was assassinated in 1922 for his support for ethnic minorities and Jews, right? So Poland back then was very diverse, many different ethnic groups, cultures, languages, and many people were not happy with Poland gaining independence because that gave the Poles more status and power, whereas they had that position under the empires. How do you think powerful people respond to finding out that their poor, uneducated neighbors are now in charge? Okay, so remember how successful social Darwinism was in promoting that competition and that individualism, those racial theories. It was accompanied by pseudo-scientific messages in academic text, in children's literature, in the newspapers. This generally reflects Europe 100 years ago, where you've got those particular racial groups, they're shown as subhuman, okay? And that includes the Poles. So they were considered these non-European barbarians, right? To fight in such a battle, you have to use similar weapons. So we can see that Korczak is publishing some of his most famous books around this time. He believes that the war is not over. And so he's using his popularity to write propaganda against the rising fascism, racism, but he's also hiding his agenda of children's rights from the adults.
You call it propaganda. In the English language, I think this is quite a negative term, usually associated with manipulation of the people.
Yes, interestingly, the negative definition for propaganda did come out of this period, out of World War I. And that was when the public found out they were deceived, you know, into giving support, the British and American people supporting the war. So we get our modern ideas about propaganda from Sigmund Freud's nephew, who created a science around this manipulating of public opinion. And it's something he called engineering consent. Now, immediately when you hear something like this engineering consent, you can see the threat to democracy here. So while most people associate propaganda with dictators and communist states, it's a lot more prevalent than you might think. These days, we actually call it marketing.
Wow, I have a definition about propaganda here that defines it as an institution or scheme for propagating a doctrine or system, an effort directed systematically towards gaining public support for an opinion or a course of action. It doesn't seem so sinister, more like something that is necessary, no?
Yes, if we look at the simple structure of the village, people knew each other personally, and we have centuries of customs, traditions that structured behavior. But when societies became more complex, cooperation and decision-making needed this form of invisible government. So we see the appearance of political factions, charismatic leaders, expert authorities, or popular influencers. Now, they were all different forms of regimenting public opinion. Now, universal voting had promised to transfer the power to the masses. But really what happened is a new elite quickly grasped the majority through propaganda as a tool of this invisible government. So it was expected in the democratic doctrine that universal education of the masses that would free the mind and will of all each individual. But the reaction instead, it brought organized propaganda. These efforts by the few to spread particular beliefs on a large scale, influencing this newfound strength of the common man, influencing them towards a certain direction. Now, we shouldn't be surprised by such aims of mass distribution, because the word propaganda actually came from the Pope in 1627. This was propaganda fide, and that meant propagation of the faith. And he was referring to a new way of educating the missionary priests that are going out into the world to convert local populations. And the idea was not to force them, but to sell them something that they thought they wanted. In that case, a new religion.
So I am now thinking differently about propaganda and wondering what it looks like. Maybe I don't even recognize it.
Well, exactly. the best propaganda is going to be disguised as something else. So, like, Kocek does not have to convince his friends, right? They already support him. What he's doing, he takes aim at his rivals and his enemies. He disguises his book so they buy it for their children. He even tells us at the beginning of King Mad that the story is not very nice and that adults won't understand it.
That's true, I think, and it's not a very happy ending.
Isn't it, Sarah?
From memory, King Mad loses the war and his kingdom, ending up in exile on a desert island.
And spoiler alert, it's even worse in the sequel. He's killed in an accident and his best friend ends up with his girlfriend. How is that happy? He dies?
Yeah, I see your point. It's quite sad for the poor little king, but it does seem to work out better for the other two, right? So let's untangle this a little. So the main character is Matt. He loves his mother and father, the queen and the king. And when they die, he becomes an orphan and he becomes the king. So it's important to say that Kocak read his work each day to the children in the orphanage, and they actually edited his drafts. They made suggestions for the plot and so on. So it would make sense to have this orphan in the lead role so that many children could identify with that sadness and that loneliness that little Matt felt. But I should also remind everyone that Kocak talked about the subjectivity of stories and that not all children will respond in the same way. He asked the question, does every child have the same type of parents or want the same treatment? So Kocak disagreed with most of the analytical methods used in contemporary literature studies because they treat certain themes and characteristics of fairy tales as universal. The journey into the unknown, you've got the encounter with the other, and these are all features common to the hero narrative. That usual purpose is to stir the young reader, you know, their subconscious, to shape their transition into adulthood. It's usually seen as a process of socialization, whereas Kocak argued that each story does not have one analysis and that different children are going to respond in different ways. And he did not want to provide this clear moral message about right and wrong. Instead, he was focused on difference in subjectivity. So I had to ask the question, was everybody happy with the king? Or could his exile and death mean liberation for the people?
Perhaps we should look from the perspective of the other characters. You underlined encountering with the other, for instance. Let's take Clue Clue as an example. We see an African girl as one of the main characters during more than half of the plot. And in addition to potential debates about her race or nationality, we witness a strong Black girl. She emphasizes that girls are capable of doing anything boys can do. And the best friend, Felek, comes from a lower socioeconomic background, right? An African girl, a poor boy, as if Kocak wanted to put forward all the dichotomics, Black and white, rich and poor, female and male. What do you think about that tensions between the characteristics of them, or what about the characters in general?
Yeah, I think you're right about this tension. And another point about both these characters that you mentioned is that they are abused and unwanted by adults. They're struggling against how society sees them and treats them, but they respond quite differently to little Matt. Felek is cunning. He's resourceful. He lives with an alcoholic father, no mother. He spends most of his time with a gang on the streets. And meanwhile, we've got Clue Clue's father is going to sacrifice her, and she's saved by an arranged marriage to Matt. It's not really that happy. So if we look at the history of Warsaw, we find these kind of aspects. We've got street gangs and prostitution, alcoholism, children stepping over people in the street and homelessness. So these are the children in Kocak's orphanage. And if you think about what they looked like and who they were, think about the Jewish girls. They're these dark skinned, curly hair. People called them wild, ugly. And then you've got the tough street kids. They were threatening people. They were stealing from their neighbors. So will all the children reading the story or hearing the story, will they imagine themselves as the sad little king? Or will some of them go on the side of these rebels?
Basha, can we discuss the African princess Clue Clue a little more? Because it is well known that children's books can be a source of stereotypes and propagate prejudice and racism. Many favorite books have been criticized, such as Twain's Huckleberry or Dahl's Oompa Loompas and Seuss's Cats in a Hat. Should we add King Mat to this list?
Well, in many children's classics, characters from other racial groups are often presented as primitive savages or childish and entertaining. So any examination of what is negative about a children's book gets us asking the question of what sort of books are useful as these critical texts for rights and democratic education. Now, it has been shown that if stories make power relations invisible, subtle messages, like you mentioned, are internalized, and children have difficulty in developing skills to identify the injustice of racism, sexism, classism, and so on. But what about if all of these stories were censored or even just removed? Do we only have stories where good defeats evil and there's always justice and always a happy ending? Do we only have, are we trying to force our versions of a good society onto a blank slate when we don't have good societies yet? So if the characters are uniformly, if they're positive or negative, how can children relate to the inconsistencies that they're already experiencing in their lives? If we clean up our stories to only show people being nice to one another, or this binary behavior of good versus evil, where can the children find their realities? Now, we already talked about this kind of objective morality when we talked about Montessori's role modeling and supervised environments in The Born Criminal. So when we read these books, not for analysis, but as a child might, we have to start and keep an open mind. That is, we have to suspend bias and hold on to that option of different perspectives and that possibility of the children themselves questioning the injustice, you know, developing their resistance to intolerance and hate. And this is what we find Korczak was observing for in the kindergarten. We have one observation where he called a three-year-old girl a rogue. And then he said that's exactly the type of revolutionary he was looking for.
You mentioned about that usefulness, and I think it's quite strange when we talk about children's literature, children's books, we always need to make them more useful, but in general literature, we just enjoy the books. So we always distinguish children's book, children's literature from literature itself. And I think it's under discussion for sure, but we many aspects to we have been discussing already. And I think on the one hand, such debates on children's books that belongs to specific era after World War II or in the middle of the increasing feminist movement, political crisis might be, these all show us how political children's literature is. On the other hand, you address the potential function usefulness of children's book to be beneficial for human rights and democracy. Here, these examples might give us a chance to consider changing perspectives of society throughout history. So can you give us a little more idea about Janusz Korczak writing and how we, or children themselves for sure, utilize these characters for democracy and human rights?
Well, quite simply, sure. Before Korczak even established his children's homes, we know that these orphanages, they ran in with self-governing institutions, parliaments and courts. He wrote about these sort of things in books about children going to summer camp as early as 1907. Now, that actually, these books that he wrote inspired children all over Poland to experiment with these ideas without any adult involvement. It was actually so widespread that Korczak had to front the teachers' union for causing a disruption to education, which of course, this was German and Russian education, not Polish education. So it's exactly what he wanted. But also if we go using that, what you said about the analysis of Korczak's children's books, using that existing literary and psychoanalytical frameworks, this is problematic. Now, we have two reasons that we have a problem with this. So firstly, Polish children's literature was viewed politically at that time. It was quite different from popular traditions. And I suppose I'd like to take you through the cultural traditions of folk tales. Yes, every culture has a storytelling tradition, but there are different histories, and at different times, these take on unexpected purpose. So most of us are thinking about Disney, and we're thinking the well-known stories of Snow White, Little Red Riding Hood, that are coming from the French or the German traditions. There was this explosion of publishing folktales in the 1800s. And these stories were usually not new, but they were collected. Like in Germany, we have the Grimm brothers. Now, one specialist in children's literature, Christina Mazzoni, she explains, for example, the Italians also collected their different regional folktales. But this was as a response to the country's unification, to Italy unifying. Now, they were sharing the stories, but they were also protecting them, because there was this risk that these diverse identities were at risk of disappearing, you know, overwhelmed and absorbed by the dominant ones. Now, on the other hand, the German stories were part of a Germanization process. They were looking at creating a shared German heritage and identity, because it was needed to form a German empire. So this period was known for Kulturkampf, that is translated as culture wars. And the stories became weapons for wiping out existing traditions amongst those different ethnic groups to create a singular identity. So these fairy tales were to replace those of your own culture. This is what you were supposed to teach your children, even if they weren't your own stories. So in the meantime, you've got the Italians working to preserve regional difference, while the Germans are creating a monoculture. They're stamping out diversity. Now, monoculture is this precursor that's required for colonization. Now, we can recall here that Kocak experienced Russification, that forced Russian oppression on his culture, but other parts of Poland were Germanized. So it was these German folktales were replacing Polish ones. So this is why Kocak insisted on writing in the Polish language. He was part of this resistance to imperial oppression, to this colonization. But it's an absolute mistake to think that he is the only one, right? So for example, if we look through my book, Our Home, Kocak calls another writer his teacher. And her name was Maria Konopnicka. She was an activist for women and children's rights. She had six children herself, and she supported her whole family as a single parent with her writing. Now, the events that she was specifically involved in, perhaps we're interested in the most, were the children's strikes. So they began in 1901, where the Polish children began refusing to say the Lord's Prayer in German. And one child wrote a poem, and that Konopnicka, the writer, she published, and she made it famous. And the children would recite this verse as their protest. And by 1906, we had 75,000 Polish children from over 1,000 schools on strike. Now, there you go. That's democracy. That's the will of the people.
I agree with you on that, Basha. Books can be inspirational, and it is interesting to think that children can judge for themselves according to their own experiences. However, when we have racist or sexist content, I think there is a different situation dealing with books that are used at school, don't you think?
Yeah, and that takes us back to that second reason for not using the existing analytical frameworks, is that we're ignoring what Kocak himself tells us about story writing, reading, and pedagogy in general. So it goes back to that being uncomfortable in our knowing, the idea of adults being uncertain. Remember that educating the educator in our last podcast episode. So for example, in my university course that I was teaching, the participants talked about being uncomfortable when they were reading King Mad. Now, we were a very culturally diverse group from all over the world, experienced professors, postgrads, teachers, parents, and they described that they were cringing, they were skipping over these awkward racist words, you know, the awful parts when they were reading it to the children, you know, that self-censorship as they were going along. they were embarrassed by such old-fashioned language, these stereotypes. They were saying, oh, poor old Korczak, you know, he didn't know any better. He's a man of his time, right? But what Korczak warns us is that parts of this book are not very nice, just like parts of society are not very nice.
Yeah, so it's so annoying. And I also had such experiences. My students were disturbed by reading that cannibal king definition was so annoying for them.
Yeah, and whereas one of the little girls that I did the research project with said she picked up the book because of that part. That was the part she wanted to find out about and think about and consider. So I think this is where we reveal our bias about what a book should look like. So when adults talk about his fairy tale, about King Mat, they call that little boy king, they call him good, clever, heroic. They really admire Mat. But I ask, did the Polish children admire their emperor? The Russian emperor or the German emperor? Did they believe that Matt should even be king? So when I read the book with those children, I mean, those kids were calling King Matt dumb. They were saying he was too little to rule, that he wasn't a hero, right? So they also told me that Korczak tricks the reader into picking up this book, right, and making it about something else. So basically, there was a 9-year-old giving me the definition of propaganda, right? So by focusing on the stereotypes of race, the adults don't seem to notice what these children did. They noticed that, they told me that the real hero was not this little boy king. They told me that it was the African princess. They said that Korczak called the book King Matt, put lots of adventure in it to trick boys into reading a story about girl power. So that's kind of where I got my idea about writing a book about Korczak and filling it with fascinating women, right? It's about spreading a message through a different vehicle. So we have dozens of studies showing, you know, those Eurocentric standards applied to female characters historically. You know, fair skin, lighter skin represents beauty and intelligence. But here we have Korczak portraying Kluku to be uniquely African. You know, her hair is not straightened, it's not silky, her skin is dark, it's not lightened. So remember that he is going against the dominant scientific views here, right, in Europe. He has to tread very carefully. And it is clear, I agree with you, that the village women are racist, absolutely. It's clear at the beginning. But watch how they slowly change their mind after spending time with her, right? So they appreciate the dark-skinned girl that's almost pretty, right? They call her unusually intelligent. So she begins as this racial stereotype, but she ends up in parliament, right? So Kluklu is an example of disruptive text. It's where the text presents these unexpected plots and protagonists from visible minorities to expose the children beyond the dominant narrative, to provide them space to think critically. So Korczak took a monumental risk, a huge risk, including a child of African heritage, but then he dared to make her the love interest and then made her one of the heroes.
Heroines.
When designing the curricula, states have an obligation to promote human rights and what Amy Gutman calls democratic education. Korczak had an opinion about that with his democratic experiences in the orphanages, I think. Can you tell us a little more about it?
Yeah, I see what you're saying, and I think it takes courage to open up schools to society. By using only certain books, pretending others don't exist, pretending other opinions don't exist, or worse, you ban them. We close schools off and we limit the possibility for the classroom to be a transformative space. We cannot use books or stories as a didactic lesson. We're not pouring information and feelings and opinions into children's hearts and minds. Children have their own individual opinions on these stories and fairy tales. They're reacting uniquely to the visuals and concepts presented with them, even if they tell us something different, right? So one child who is scared when the wolf eats grandma, the other child inside is cheering and clapping, happy to be free of that old witch. You know, they hate grandma, right? So the educational philosopher Nell Noddings gives us this alternative to viewing children as innocent. So she explains that by the time they're reading such stories, children already have real life experiences of power relations in a corrupt society. Now, we will remember that Kochak's children, they were aged 7 to 14 years. And that's similar to the children that I worked with in the research project of reading the story. Now, they told me they hear much worse swear words and racist comments than what the adults were trying to take out of King Mad and out of these stories. They opened up and talked to me about their daily lives, the racism that they experienced every day, everything from name calling to physical assaults, gang violence, homelessness, abuse of drugs, alcohol, and of course the physical abuse.
That's real life.
Yeah, exactly. And where is their position if we're giving them these, oh, girl power, good stories, I suppose. So the book is not utopian. It's not saying this is how the world should be, but it's presenting possibilities for the children to discuss how the world is, how they see their world. That's whether we like what they say or not. And Kochak was aware of this emotional toll that's exacted on children in violent societies. He viewed these stories as providing the opportunity for developing the tools for dealing with their anger and sadness. He even gave it a name, which is baikotherapia, which is folktale therapy, right? So although there is a strong argument that racist books inflict damage, by ignoring them, we're only treating the symptoms. We're erasing this problem in our history. So instead, when we allow children to be outraged, to be upset by books, it's not just an outlet for their real life problems, but it's this emotional interest can translate into a political interest. And our role here is supporting children's agency, right? So Kochak is explaining that these stories are not inert. They're providing a reflective space. So the children are forming a relationship, not with the author, not with us, not with the characters, but with the book itself. So it goes against our intellect that we might learn something about this book and society from the children, about their reality, right? So it reminds me of a really terrible situation talking to a teacher in a school where a brother and a sister were murdered by their family. And she said she couldn't believe it because these children were so happy at school. Now, I have to say these adults had no idea what kind of hell was outside the school gates. They were living in their own fairy tale, right? Remember our previous discussion on the magical thinking when we made fun of children who believe in unicorns and fairies? I mean, this is what we're telling them at school, right? Well, Kochak's turning this around by looking at the adult fairy tales. And he calls out this attitude to children. He calls it an expression of adult egocentrism, right? He's asking us to be childish, right? And see how difficult it is to not believe in certain fairy tales. Remember how difficult people found it to reconcile this idea that the earth revolved around the sun, that it was just a planet, like that profound belief of the masses that the Great War would be no more wars in the 20th century. Of course, people were wrong, right? What about in our daily lives? We've got rational people pretending, even when they've got evidence, they just can't accept. All of us believe in some ways in fairy tales. That's what we use to protect ourselves, and that's what we use to keep hope alive.
And I think that's why we need literature for not only children or adults, not by separating them. We need artworks. We need artworks to keep hope, to keep our hopefulness, I can say. And I definitely agree with you about children's supporting, Kochak supporting children's agency through his writing. And I think in the contemporary world, we have been facing various human rights crises again and again. It's maybe different than his, John Skorczak's life periods. But nowadays, we can never claim that racism suddenly disappeared from the world. Indeed, the reverse of it. I think the beginning of the 21st century has specific similarities with the beginning of the previous one, 20th century. For instance, we witness the hostility against migrants, even refugees, after all the globalization process people have experienced. It's just like people never learned about anything. Even though we have all been migrants of the world, we still discuss our roots.
At this point, we can briefly mention the recent political crisis. We know, Basha, you have also worked on the concepts of solidarity in anarchist philosophy. How about we can round full circle and talk about this in relation to individualism and Darwin's evolutionary theory?
Okay, so if we come full circle and we talk a little bit about this history of this period, in England and France around 1904, we had an anarchist publish his theory of mutual aid. And it was an absolute revelation, you know, in Western European society. So his idea was that the struggle for survival was not a competition between individuals, but it required cooperation to survive against nature, right? So there's a lot published on mutual aid, these cooperative strategies. So I want to point out something else that's usually missed. So this will be useful for our ideas around democracy that we've talked about earlier. So what this theory challenged is that the world exists in harmony, that there is peace, or that there is any possibility of a preconceived order that we can work towards, that will achieve this order that we envisage, this predetermined idea. The argument dismisses that there's any force governing the world peacefully. It's a bit like when religious people declare that God works in mysterious ways. It's not a preconceived plan. So a lot of people at that time, they were very fascinated with the biological arguments. We're quite familiar with evolution. but these writers also used natural sciences, geology and physics to explain their ideas. So let's think about the chaotic, those incoherent movements at the molecular and cellular level. This is invisible to the human eye. When we think about this, they are disorderly. they're disorderly, they're divergent, but they're held together in an equilibrium, right? From the micro to the cosmic scale. At any one point, that harmony that we see, that peace, this is a static illusion because this is formed by the tension produced by those opposing forces within the whole, okay? So that system is continuously in motion. It's in conflict. The forces are obstructing, resisting, adjusting, adapting. If we hamper and prevent one force, we stop that movement here, it doesn't destroy it. It doesn't remove the conflict, right, for another, but it actually serves to increase the effect. It builds up pressure. It accumulates that energy and that mass. Now, a lot of my research deals with the historical period of revolution, and I've got a couple of favorite metaphors to explain what might be going on. So let's imagine a mountain. It's a triangle hierarchy, right? You've got the peak and you've got the bottom in a triangle. Mm-hmm. Now, if we imagine that this mountain was once a volcano, so here there are forces that are imprisoned inside, right? They're building up over time. And if they're not released, you create sufficient pressure, right? That's going to shatter through that petrified old lava rock, you know, that those old geological formations, it's going to pour out. But when it comes out, it's unpredictable, right? And there's mm-hmm. all sorts of different things that come out. We get lava, we get flame, we get gas, we get ash, not just the one thing that we expect. And not in the one place.
So both regions and smell, I think.
Exactly. And that illustrates that tension between order and chaos. So we might get that volcano looking like a mountain, laying there dormant, silent. And while it's there, you get that gradual evolutionary change over eons, right? Mm-hmm. So that the wearing of the rock, the smaller changes. But a catastrophic event, that precipitates the revolutionary change, right? And that's a combination of factors. When you get the mass below, have got that enough energy, enough force to redistribute that force, and they can rupture the equilibrium from below. So we can think of ourselves like scientists. We're studying volcanic activity, that the geology, the lay of the land, right? So social research can provide us with some new interpretations of how that past is informing the present. And it's simultaneously, it's foretelling the future, because that violent eruption that we see in the classroom or on the streets, it's not so spontaneous. It's got a lot to do with the idea of democracy. And so most people are thinking of a majority rule as a political system, okay? So especially in the United States, we've got democracy imagined as this artificial imposition upon the people. They refer to the Roman republics, to constitutions, to elections, whereas I'm suggesting a collective concept of democracy, right? As a force of nature. And this is a bit more difficult to comprehend if we're sticking with those usual political theories, right? So let's use a metaphor again, okay? Let's imagine this flowing river, okay? Now, the flowing river, it can symbolize time or change if you like, okay? If you look at this river, it doesn't flow straight. Rivers don't flow straight. They're caught up in little currents. There are little whirlpools. Some parts are faster, some parts are slower. We've got those stagnant pools which don't seem to be moving, right? When it flows fast, the water is ripping into the riverbanks and it tears away the edges and the river changes course. When it's slow, it dredges the bottom. It brings up all that mud and itself becomes muddy. Now, again, let's imagine that this is society flowing over time. If it's very fast or very slow, it's going to pick up new people from the edges or from the bottom, and it swirls them into the pool, right? So the people often, they only have the choice to swim with the stream, conform, or drown. But now the water is different, right? Because together they're changing the quality of it. They're changing the course of it by joining in. Where these weak people from the bottom, from the sides, when they organize, when they cooperate, they gain strength. So competition might be the way of struggle for the powerful, for the good swimmers, right? Mm-hmm. But it is cooperation that is the strength of the weak. And together, they can change the course of the river. They can explode a volcano.
You have used such powerful metaphors, and you just brought us from somewhere to somewhere, from physics and geology to social science and literature again. It was quite strange. And I guess you emphasize how the differences make us hierarchy, right? And here I can refer to King Matt one more time. Remember, Matt talks about the similarities instead of differences. The little children know what little children need, and the big children know what big children need, he claims. It sounds like identity politics in a sense. But I think it's more than this, because he also tries to find out a way to combine the movement of children with the green flag by reminding the readers of green, the color of forest. Under this flag, they might start something new. Instead of a kingdom, they have the power to reform. Basha, let me refer to your book, Our Home. On page 24, you are explaining the characters, Matt, the owner of the kingdom, and his friend, Kluklu, who is an African girl, etc. And here you pointed out their difference, like that. I'm reading that part. In contrast to Matt's sometimes tyrannical demands, Kluklu demonstrates an understanding of democratic leadership its risks and limitations through this powerful expression of yours. Can we link this literary work of James Korczak to an attempt for democracy, or what kind of political aspects do you understand from his writing?
Yes, yeah, so perhaps to understand the implications for democracy for today, I can explain it using the title of this episode, The Kingdom is a Game. We get this from a philosopher around the time of ancient Greece. It's pre-Socratic. And back then in ancient Greece, when a peace treaty was struck, when two city-states were at war, the treaty was recorded on a piece of pottery called the Symbolon, where we get this idea of the symbol, okay? So the Symbolon was broken into pieces and it was given to each member of the alliance. So it could only be understood when the piece was put together as a whole, right? It didn't mean anything in two pieces unless they stuck together with their tension, their peace, keeping it as a whole. Symbolically. So this political alliance is a foundational concept to understanding the democratic mesh. That's when, you know, you have these opposing factions that have to work together for a common cause. We can see a lot of examples right now in societies around the world with the pandemic around what this mesh means and what it doesn't mean when they don't have the common cause. So it's a unity of opposites. We've talked about this before when we emphasize the unity of intellect and intuition, virtue and vice, mm-hmm. and so on, right? Now the symbol and pottery pieces, we need to know this is also the name of the pieces of a game, pasoi. The pasoi are these pieces. So we hear an ancient quote, pre-Socratic, which says, time is a child playing, moving pasoi, pieces, and the kingdom belongs to the child. So wow. As life and time flows, right, the child is manipulating and challenging the political pieces, moving them, changing them around, threatening that balanced state of play. Remember that these are broken pieces just held together just by that old agreement. So when you get a comfortable status quo that's been achieved by the generations of old, even if it's taken hard work, you know, all the right things for maintaining peace, you've got new players, new rules who are growing the conflict again. And in turn, they're progressing cultural knowledge and change. So we might see that an adult is comfortable. They might even give up, right? Because they're used to this reality of the social position mm-hmm. and those resources that they have at the disposition. They give up playing the game. But the energetic child can still fight. And that imaginative child, well, I mean, they can call up their soldiers. They can have horses from Styx. You know, they can change the playing field. They can change the way the game is played until they have a more convincing semblance of reality becomes available. Right? So we have to think of the game not as leisure, not as entertainment, because we usually think of a game as fun, but instead we've got to think of it played in deadly earnest. This is what Korczak would say. He explained, you know, running and playing soldier games or cops and robbers, and they're playing chasey, and partway through one child runs across the grass, which is banned, you know, it's forbidden. You cannot run across the grass in the game. But this is a military strategy. This is life and death, he says, right? The game embodies the whole child. It's not just what adults have said, this is play or this is competition or this is work or learning or daydreaming or absence. The game of life is played by the leaders, the followers, the cheaters, the spectators, the coaches, the managers, referees. And the children, the children include the living, the animate, the non-living, the inanimate, right? So we can hear it when we read Korczak's running commentary on episodes of play. It's political and philosophical.
So Korczak is not merely observing to assess children's learning or development, but perhaps conducting sociological research. It reminds me of how chess used to be a political game only played by powerful people in the kingdom.
Yes. So originally those board games, those symbolic board games such as chess, they had political meaning. They were acting as similes for the city, and it was about being a citizen is to play the game. And we remember back then, not everyone was a citizen, right? So when we award more status to games, we should think of them, I suppose, well, we do think of them as these interpretation potential as sites for ideological contests. Usually we think of the game as this repetitive vehicle that we are impressing these fully formed ideas of the game onto the young, right? So like in chess, it's already a fully formed ideological context. It has a way of playing. So we leave little room for the agency of that active participant, because all the power for the transmission of the cultural knowledge is held within the game. But children play creatively. They play without this predetermined endpoint. They unground knowledge. They unsettle those assumptions that cause us to rethink the very structure of the game. That radical person child plays to challenge existing assumptions and traditions. They reconfigure the material world into these new patterns. So the game is a model for what the world is. Yeah, it's not a transmission of traditional knowledge. Children are, they're the masters of make-believe. They've got the abilities of natural theists. They can infuse the levels of real present day power with the most fantastic magical thinking. So they just juxtapose that divine belief in heroics. They mount crusades against the ideology of the elite. It's holy anarchy, right? But it doesn't belittle the mortal present day status of the king. It does have the power to topple the reigning monarchy, because the new power, as they organize, is emerging from below. So the game in Korczak text manifests as his theory on the emergence of cultural and epistemological structures. This is the ever-flowing child's play in the river of time. That's his philosophy of life.
So the kingdom is a game, or maybe the game is the kingdom. And maybe if playing is such a powerful weapon, as you say, then children's right to play is the hidden key to social change or revolution. In any case, that might be a topic for future conversations. For now, this is the end of our podcast and our first series. In the name of the Critical Childhood and Youth Studies Collective, we thank Vasha Vucic for sharing with us her deep reflections on Janusz Korczak's ideas on education, philosophy, and political theory. That will be all for now. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vasha.